This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, local filmmaker Sky Bergman has written a book as a companion to Lives Well Lived.
With the film and with the book, I am showing people that aging can be something to be celebrated. And that's so important for people of all ages to realize.
Also, Playing with Food went to Slow Public Market to learn about bao, those delicious stuffed buns.
Well, it's all made by hand, so you're talking about somebody physically wrapping every single one of those by hand.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 24th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with peace, love, and pets.
I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society. My guest today is Dr. Raffi Dorian. Dr. Dorian is the founder and partner of Vetama Central Coast, a veterinary practice providing mobile veterinary care and services to dogs and cats on the Central Coast. Today, we are going to chat about some summer safety tips for our pets. Hey, doctor, welcome to Peace, Love, and Pets.
Oh, it's great to be here again.
Good reminders for things that you and I both see, whether it's in your practice or in shelters. We all kind of deal with some of those summer things that are very, very common in this area. We are seeing lots of fleas, ticks, foxtails this time of year.
Yeah, so I think the fleas and the ticks in our area here are a big deal. We're lucky that in this time we have a lot of good flea and tick preventatives that we can use. And so if your dog is going out and about hiking and enjoying the Central Coast, I can guarantee you they're going to get exposed to fleas and they're going to get exposed to ticks. And I think what people don't remember or maybe don't realize is how many diseases those parasites can give your pet. And especially ticks around here, we can see Rocky Mountain spotted fever, another disease called Ehrlichia. And all these are blood parasites that when the tick bites them, they get injected in their body and then they can get sick weeks to months later. So prevention is really the key.
So what are some of the options for pet parents?
Yeah, so basically to keep it simple, you're going to have topicals, which are basically liquids that you can put on the back of the neck, on the skin. Then they have pills that you can give. And then now they have actually collars that you can use too. So those are sort of all the options that you have out there. And you just have to pick the one that's going to work best for your pet.
And are most of those prescription required?
The majority are. All the oral medications are going to be prescriptions. There are a moderate amount of products that are topical that you can get without a vet's prescription. So there's a lot of over-the-counter things you can get. Some of the older medications, Advantage and Frontline, if you remember those, those you can get over-the-counter and buy them at the pet stores.
Okay.
So there's no excuse to not have your pet on something.
Yeah.
Now, if they're totally indoors and never go outside, you could rethink that and maybe your pet doesn't need it.
Okay, and then that other nasty F word, foxtails. Man, do I hate foxtails. We all have our foxtail story, unfortunately.
Living in California, most people are going to know what foxtails are, but those little stickers that when the weeds dry out, they float around in the air and they're on the ground. Those things can go anywhere. So anywhere, nose, eyes, ears, between the toes and the rear end, we'll see them go into any part of the body. And nature's built them really nice. So basically they keep working their way into the body and they don't come out. So they'll go deeper and deeper. And if they go very deep, they can affect important organs. They can get into the lungs, the heart, the brain. Obviously those things would be fatal if that happened. So if you think your pet has been exposed to foxtails and the classic signs would be their eye is shut because it's in their eye. They'd be shaking their head a lot because it got in their ear, or if they're sneezing nonstop, I would head to the vet. Between the toes is very common too. And what you'll see there is a big red bump and maybe a little hole. If you see that, get to the vet as soon as you can, because there's a chance they can go in there with some tweezers or other instruments, grab it and pull it right out, and then that's it. Mm. Whereas if you wait, it'll work up the foot and into the arm.
Is there one spot that you find is the most common that you see?
Probably nose and ears. Mm-hmm. That's the most common, yeah.
And that's like immediate. You have to head to the vet like immediately.
You do, because especially the nose, because that'll work its way up. And there's a thin layer of tissue and bone between the sinuses and your brain. And so when it gets back in there, it can work through that and it'll stay in there. And there's only so far we can reach in with instruments. Mm. So if it goes too far back, then it's out of reach, and then that would require surgery to remove it. So that's a really big deal. Same with the ears. If you leave a foxtail in the ears, it can rupture the eardrum and then work its way into the middle ear. And that's a big deal, too. We don't want that to happen.
And I am seeing the amount of time during the year that I'm seeing foxtail continues to grow. We have gotten more rain the last few years, which means everything is growing and blooming, and even they drop, and I find them in the gutters, on the streets. They could be anywhere. The wind has blown them, and it just takes one little sniff from a dog, and there it goes right up the nose.
I think they've invented some nets and things you can put over dogs' heads, like the ones that are going through the weeds.
It looks pretty intense, but I have some friends that live on property, and their dogs, after a few treats and some positive reinforcement, they put it on, and then they can romp and go all through the property without that fear, at least of the face. The paw is still a problem possibility, but I've seen some dogs accept those pretty nicely.
Yep. And one last thing on that: if you take your dog out for a walk and you are going places where there are foxtails, take 5 minutes and then do an inspection on your dog and just look everywhere for any of them, because it takes time for those things to get embedded. And so many times you can pull them out before it's a problem.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society. And my guest today on Peace, Love, and Pets is Dr. Dorian from Vet Tama Central Coast. Let's talk 4th of July. Not the best holiday for our loved pets.
It really isn't. And I think, the biggest thing is going to obviously be the fireworks and the loud noises. And, we have a lot of animals now that are anxious. They have anxiety problems. And those loud noises just make everything worse. So if you can not be around fireworks with your pets, I think it's totally the right thing to do. Like, I wouldn't take my dog to the fireworks show. There's no reason for that, at least in my opinion. If you're going to be home and you can't help hearing the noises, turn the music on a little louder, sit with your pet, maybe sit in the middle of the house where the sound is not going to get through as much. If you feel that your pet is really anxious and there's nothing you can do, I would encourage you to talk to your vet, because there are anti-anxiety medicines and sedatives you can give just for that night to help them get through it. In essence, you got to think about it. If they get really panicky, they're having a panic attack, and you need to stop it before it gets to that point.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to pet them out of a panic attack and give them cookies and tell them they're going to be okay. They are in fear survival mode at that point, panicked. We hear about dogs going through windows, pushing their way through doors. I mean, doing things that are not in their normal character. There's some dogs that are a little shaky, or they might get a little whiny if they hear a loud noise, but there is a difference to some of those animals that have a real sensitivity and anxiety problem.
Oh yeah, they're having a full-blown panic attack. They're not going to listen to anything. And then that's when animals get loose too. Mm-hmm. And so make sure your pet has a microchip, especially if you have a pet that is anxious like that, because there's a higher chance they are going to get loose.
Right.
So I feel like making sure they have an active microchip that's registered is very important.
Yeah, and really it's just important to start thinking about it now and having a plan. So if you are going out, what's the plan for the pet? If it's at home alone and there's going to be neighborhood type friends, family, setting off some firecrackers, things like that, poppers in the street, any of those things, if it's loud for us, think about what that feels like for them. And they don't know it's a holiday, and they don't know it's a festivity.
Right.
They are just fearful at that time.
Well, keep in mind, they can hear better than us too.
Yeah.
So whatever we're hearing is much louder for them. And I think on that note, we tend to forget about the cats.
Yeah.
And so they're scared too. And so don't forget about that. And the other thing is, talk to your vet ahead of time. Like you said, plan ahead. I can't tell you how many calls I get the day before, because people just realize, oh, tomorrow's 4th of July, I got to get sedatives. And it's doable, but sometimes the pharmacies are closed, and you may not get those meds in time. So
yeah, so make a plan. If you're going to be leaving, where is your pet? Is it in the backyard where it can bolt? Is it going to be able to go through a screened window? Can it be in a crate? Maybe you have the cat in a laundry room with some music on just for the couple hours that you're going to be gone. Just remember that they will not act like they normally do when you leave just to go to the grocery store or something if there's fireworks and things like that going on. So really, it's about making a plan, whether you're at home with them, whether you're leaving them. I also agree taking them to the festivities where there's that chance. I don't think it's quite enjoyable for most pets. Right. I know some are really, social and they can do parades and they can do things like that. But gosh, why risk it? If you aren't sure of how your pet is going to behave. So now's the time. Think about if you need to talk to your vet in advance. Don't leave your dog or cat outside during the evening hours, because that truly is the biggest time that we find lost and found pets, unfortunately. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society, and my guest today on Peace, Love, and Pets is Dr. Dorian from Vet Tama Central Coast. We also want to talk about hot temperatures. We live in this beautiful area where we are seeing temperatures all over the place.
Yeah, so heat stroke is a big deal during the summer. I mean, we live in an area, like you said, that the temperature can fluctuate. You could be on the beach where it's 70, you go inland and then it's 100 degrees, and it doesn't take much time for your car to heat up. I think everybody knows that. So I think leaving a pet in the car is pretty much, I think, unacceptable at this point. And so just plan your day accordingly. The typical signs of heat stroke that you should be watching for in dogs and cats for that matter, but we're going to talk about dogs, I think, focus on them, is panting is the biggest thing when they start to get hot. So a dog doesn't have sweat glands like we do. So the only way they can get rid of excess heat is by panting and then sweating from their feet. So they don't have the ability to sweat all over, so they can't cool their bodies as quick as we can. When the heat stroke gets worse, typically you'll start seeing tremors, vomiting, disorientation, and then they'll collapse. And that by then, you know you're in a lot of trouble. And that'll happen not only in the car, but when you're going for hikes, things like that. You don't realize it. When you're on a hike, I encourage everybody to get on the ground, on the trail, and see how hot it is on the ground compared to where you are standing high up. So it gets much hotter down there. So make sure you have plenty of fresh water, give them breaks, sit in the shade for a little bit. If you think your pet has heat stroke, I mean, the bottom line is you got to get to the vet as soon as possible. And what the vet's going to do is try to bring down that temperature as quick as they can, but safely. So you can have trouble, like some people think, oh, just pour ice water on them like that. That actually will cause more problems.
Yeah.
So you have to bring that temperature down slowly. And we have sort of techniques that we can do that with. But I think the key is identifying those signs as quick as possible and not letting it get to that point.
If we do come back from a walk and we think we may have overdid it a little bit, but it's not danger of passing out or running to the vet ER, cool cloths on certain parts of the body, is that helpful?
It totally is. Okay. And in knowing that they sweat from their feet, a lot of times what I'll do is I'll put cool water, you know, once again, not ice water, but cold water on their feet, and that'll cool them off much quicker. You can put obviously cold washcloths on their body as well. And the goal is to slowly bring their temperature down. I wouldn't use ice water for them to drink. Once again, it's just going to be cool water.
Okay.
And then if they drink, then that's a good sign. Typically, if they're really bad off, they're going to not even drink. They're just going to lay there and be panting. And sometimes they'll have trouble with oxygen, so the color of their gums will turn darker red. And that's also a bad sign that you're having trouble.
Car rides, grocery store trips, errands during our hotter temperatures is just, like you said, not acceptable at this point. It's not worth the risk, whether something happens to the pet, somebody sees a pet in a car, breaks a window, then you have this whole scene that you're dealing with. Somebody calls the police to report it. Let's just avoid those situations. And now there's some fancy cars that have like dog modes, and that's very confusing to us because I want to get a little upset, like, oh, the dog's in there with the windows up, and we start, you know, panicking, and then we'll find that there are certain cars that actually do have a ability to keep the air on for the dog. So I've seen some people leave little notes on
that
the window, like,
safe.
Don't worry,
yes,
the air's on, they're listening to music, they're listening to KCBX right now, don't worry about them.
And I guess that's okay, but even then, you know, what if something fails? So, you know, I think just don't risk it too much. You know, maybe a 10-minute trek in the shop, and you come back in if you have an electric car that can do that. But otherwise,
it's
I'd still
rare.
Be careful.
Yeah, it's rare. Yeah. So, okay, so we covered all of those summer safety tips. Something we don't talk about often enough, but it is a part of owning a pet. And because you have your mobile services, we do have more options these days for at-home euthanasia. And being a big proponent of that for people, I know planned euthanasia is not always a choice for people, but a lot of times with aging pets or pets that you know that time is coming soon, it is a great option instead of a traumatic emergency rushing somewhere in that kind of hospital type environment. Right. So I absolutely love that more people are choosing this.
Sure. I think that house call services in general lower the stress so much compared to going into a vet clinic. And so the most stressful thing a pet and a pet parent can go through is euthanasia. A house call euthanasia, I think it's a gift because it just changes everything for everybody. It gives you privacy. You know, you're not in a hospital. And keep in mind, there are times when you're in a hospital situation, you have no choice. And that's, you do what you got to do. But if time permits and you're able to do this, I think looking into house call euthanasia, if your pet needs that at that time, I think it's appropriate. The other thing too, I think it's important when you have your pet having troubles, is most vets will do quality of life assessments. And that's the first step to that euthanasia part, to make sure there's not other things that you can do. So I would encourage everybody to talk to their vet if they have older pets and they're worried about something, to make sure you're on the appropriate meds and all that. But I always look at quality of life and making sure if the pet is suffering and there's no good outcome to this, then I think it's okay to say goodbye. You know, it's hard. It's really hard.
It's like the most difficult thing.
It is.
Because they can't talk to us. We can't talk it through. We can't get their consent, their opinions. And they're such troopers for us that if we see their tail wagging or they're still eating, we think they have great quality of life. Yeah. But I find so many pet parents after the fact say, I probably should have done it a few months ago. And then we feel guilty. Then we feel bad. They're going to still wag their tail at us, right?
Well, of course. And I think that's the thing to keep in mind, is that they don't realize that they're sick, or if they have cancer or heart failure, all those things. They know they don't feel good, but they're not thinking like we would, like, oh my gosh, I have something
it's coming, right? Yeah, no.
So they don't have that part. And I think we just need to enjoy the time we have with them. And then if that time comes, just know that you're making that decision to help them. And if you don't, I always look at it too, if you don't make that decision, what would happen? They're going to continue to go down this pathway. Maybe they're not eating, they're having trouble breathing, whatever it is. And they're going to continue to go through that. And there's a point where that turns into suffering. Yeah. And, you know, the goal here is to relieve suffering.
And the chance that they peacefully go to bed one night and pass in their dreams. I mean, I wish that was the reality for everybody, but the chance of that happening is slim. Usually we do have to make that choice, and that's our responsibility as their guardians.
I agree totally. It's not that common where they pass away in their sleep. Okay. And so you're left with this decision to make. And it depends on the veterinarian. Maybe if we have the time, I can quickly take 30 seconds to tell you sort of what to expect. I mean, if you went through euthanasia. So basically, most veterinarians will give an injection of either an anesthetic or a sedative. And then basically the pet gets sleepy or actually gets anesthetized. They don't feel anything. Mm-hmm. And then they'll give a second shot, which is the euthanasia solution. And that's, they pass away from that. So if the process is done like that, typically they pass away very peacefully. Mm-hmm. If I want to almost say 100% of the mm-hmm. time. The only issue is, depending on whatever health concern they have, sometimes they can have issues with that. So, but it's as peaceful as it can be. And I always say, this is the way I want to go. If it's going to be my time.
We don't get that.
I know we don't. But if we did, this is the way I'd want to go, because, you know, sometimes a transition from this life to the next is not as peaceful as we would like. And by using these medications, it can make that happen.
And I think that there's some talk between pet owners on it's too hard for them to be with their pet. And then some would never not be with their pet during that time. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think that's a personal choice. Yeah. And as you know, I've experienced a lot of euthanasias, and it runs the gamut. There's people there for the whole thing. There's people that don't want to be there at all. And there's everything in between. I think you have to decide on what is okay for your heart. Mm-hmm. Know that as veterinarians, we know how important this time is. Mm-hmm. And so whatever, whether you're present or not, it's all going to be compassionate. Mm-hmm. I haven't met a vet that's not going to be compassionate with that. So,
well, good
hard.
Information. Yeah. I nobody wants to talk about no. that. But no matter what the age, it's always a possibility. I love that this is an option for people. You obviously offer it with your service, but there's a few other locals that will come to your house. But it's nice to have that conversation, talk about it, have a plan. So if it happens on a Saturday at 3 a.m.,
right. And there's a lot of fear involved with it. And I think if you know things ahead of time, it can at least get a little bit of the fear to go away. Not going to get rid of the sadness, but at least the fear part.
But a peaceful passing is all we could ever wish for it people is. And animals. How can people learn more about you, your services?
So you can reach us. Our website is vettama.com. I encourage you to have good communications with your own veterinarian. That we're all here to help pet and pet parents.
Well, as we wrap up here, I want to thank my guest, Dr. Dorian. I'm a big fan of mobile vet services as an option for people and pets and appreciate what you have brought to the Central Coast. I want to make sure to also share the weeks around 4th of July are the busiest week for animal shelters, and not in a good way, but the busiest time for lost and found animals. Shelters are already overcrowded. Statistics show that 70% of lost dogs are found within 1 mile of their home, and of that 70%, 43% are found within 400 feet of their home. Only 16% of dogs are returned to their owners after entering a shelter. So if you ever find a pet, please check to see if they are chipped. You can do that at any vet office, and if the shelters are open, we have scanners out there as well. Getting them chipped is the best way to reunite with them, even within minutes or hours versus days or weeks or months. And if they don't have a chip, walk them around the neighborhood. That is the best thing you can do. Somebody around your neighborhood has seen that dog walking with its owner. Maybe they're out of town. Maybe they're at work. Posting on groups like Nextdoor, Facebook Lost and Found pages have been really successful in our area. And I really want to remind people to report found or lost animals to Slo County Animal Services. They are the legal agency here in our county. Woods is not permitted to take in any lost or found pets, so they really do have to be reported to the county shelter. That is the legal agency where hopefully people are going to look for their lost pets and they can get reclaimed. The county has a website, a whole page where you can fill out a report. You can view animals that have been picked up, but we really want to get those animals reclaimed, because after that stray hold, they become available and they start a whole new life, and their family is probably missing and looking for them. They just didn't come to the shelter. County Animal Services, they have a whole information on their website, and both shelters are closed on 4th of July, so we cannot help any lost pets, unfortunately, on the holiday. So we're really trying hard to get the word out there in advance. Let's keep those pets safe. And for all things Woods, visit woodshumanesociety.org. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you for listening to Peace, Love, and Pets on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods. Don't forget, your new best friend is waiting for you at the shelter.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangerman. Up next, we'll hear from local filmmaker Sky Bergman, who's written a book to go along with her film, Lives Well Lived.
Hello, I'm Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio on the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Sky Bergman to discuss her new book, Lives Well Lived, Generations, Resilience, Positivity, and Purpose at Every Age. Welcome, Sky.
Thank you for having me.
I must say, this book is just amazing, and the accompanying DVD as well, and for all kinds of reasons which we'll delve into. But if you could begin the conversation by talking a little bit about yourself and how you got to this point to write this book.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm 58 years old, and when I started working on the whole Lives Well Lived series, as you mentioned, I have a film out right now on PBS by the same name. I was in my 40s and looking at approaching 50 and looking for positive role models of aging and just not finding them out there in the world. And in my own family, I had my grandmother who was approaching 100 and was just amazing. And I started on a quest, really, with my grandmother, interviewing her about what made a well-lived life and why, how did she get to that point where she was so positive, so active, so engaged. And so I spent 4 years interviewing 40 people with a collective life experience of 3,000 years and have never looked back since then. then.
So let's go through the book a little bit. How did you choose the people you're going to interview?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I realized that I was going to do a film, I sent out an email blast to a number of people, my friends, my family, all the students that I've taught over the years at Cal Poly. And I said, here's a link to a little 1 minute clip that I did of my grandmother working out at the gym. And if you have somebody in your life that's as much an inspiration as my grandmother is to me, then please nominate them for this project. I had no idea I was going to do a film at that point. And I was really inundated by heartwarming nominations.
Is it safe to say or to assume that most or all of your interviewees were from the Central Coast?
I would say 75% of them were from the Central Coast. I did interview some people outside of the Central Coast, like in LA, San Francisco, Santa Fe. But for the most part, they were in the Central Coast. And I think that just proves that you could do a project like this anywhere. Everyone has an amazing story to tell if we take the time to listen. And I think we often don't do that. And I have this gift of spending 4 years to do that.
What was your, what did you teach at Cal Poly? Did it set you up for this?
Well, yeah, I was a photography teacher and then I also went into video, but really I'd never done any video until my grandmother came out to visit me for the first time when she was 96. She lived in Florida and I'm here in California, and she was an amazing cook who never wrote a recipe down.
Ah.
And so I realized that I had this golden opportunity to film her, because at that point digital cameras were also allowing you to do video. And I thought, I don't want to just write the recipe down. I want to see the gesture of her hands, hear the sound of her voice, and see her cooking. And that was really my first foray into doing any kind of video work, was doing that.
I have actually met some of the people in the book and are still in awe of what they accomplished and what they represent. And I'm sure they have their dark moments. I have to share, and I hope this doesn't get bleeped out, but with Dr. Tadone's interview, and I used to, of course, bought his mozzarella cheese at the deli in Shell Beach quite often. But they asked him something about being a busy pediatrician, having 9 kids. How did he do that? And he said something like, I never get a headache. And really, you have to read that twice.
Right. Why did he have 9 kids? Because he never got a headache.
He never got a headache. It's a classic Tadone, I suppose.
Yes.
Why do you think these icons and the wisdom that lies within their spirits, why do you think that they're bypassed or ignored? Is there an obvious reason, a dark reason? What do you think?
Well, I think we often don't take the time to sit and talk to people. I mean, I think especially now we're on our devices, we're running here and there, and we don't really take the time to learn about people's history. And I think that is so important. That was such a gift that I was able to do that, to spend the time really talking to people and hearing about what their stories were, where they came from, their stories. Most of their stories are stories of resilience, of things that they went through, how they overcame that, how they remained positive. And I think there are so many lessons that can be learned from that. And that's why, really, for me, the next extension of my film was really creating intergenerational projects to bring generations together, because I feel like we are living in such an age-segregated world. And I especially feel that because I'm teaching at a university, so I keep getting older. My students stay the same age, but they are pretty much isolated to just, being around their age group. And I was lucky enough to grow up in a 4-generational household, and what a gift that was to have all those generations around me, all that wisdom around me. And so we work bringing older adults and students together. And I think that, like any other ism, when you know somebody from that other group, that ism disappears, because now somebody is your friend from that other group. And what we've learned through doing these projects, which I've been working with a professor that teaches psychology of aging, Sarah Bartlett, and what we learn at the end of the quarter, the students and the older adults all say that they realize there's far more in common than their differences, and really the only difference is their age. And what a wonderful experience that is, to have them come together and learn that and take that out there in the world.
Some of our rituals of respecting the elderly and listening to the elderly have faded and become blurred, but I think a lot of it is consumer-driven, capitalism, technology-driven, that the people who want ads responded to see young people as a bigger market than the elderly, let's say, and maybe who are more frugal. That loss of intergenerational learning, I think, is really, in a sense, puts our society at risk. very serious aspect of that is, and I think it's something that your book addresses very well. History is written usually based on what are called primary resources, like books, newspaper articles, diaries, and no one keeps those kinds of things. At least if they do keep them, they're not necessarily online, and if they are online, they might be lost anyway. So I think this kind of an effort is pretty huge. Is that something do you think you've been able to get across to your students? And I think the seniors already know this.
Well, I think that I'm fortunate enough that we've been doing these intergenerational projects across the country. And because I'm working with PBS, PBS Learning Media has an intergenerational project using the film on their website for K-12 educators. So I'm doing what I can to help generate and foster those conversations between generations. And I would venture to say that ageism is in both directions. I feel like, you know, young people also have ageism directed at that. Maybe they're, that, you know, that in quotes, they're too young to do something. And so I think it's really important to try and get over those stereotypes. And I do think one of the reasons why, as I was approaching 50, that I wanted to do this film and now the book is because I think that in the media in particular, the things that you see about aging are all the things that we can do to avoid aging, whether it's using anti-aging creams or all the things that can make us more, in quotes, youthful. And the reality is the one thing that we all have in common is that we are aging every day. So right. Why should we not embrace that? We should be looking forward to it rather than dreading it. And the media portrays it as something that we should dread and not look forward to. And so I think that with the film and with the book, I am showing people another vantage point and showing people that aging can be something to be celebrated. And that's so important for people of all ages to realize.
Before we go any further, please tell us there's some an event or two that's coming up in terms of launching your book. Where and when would that happen?
We're doing a big book signing at Slow Provisions on July 5th from 5 to 8 p.m. I'm super excited about that. It's in conjunction with my friend Paula DeLay, who's a beautiful painter, who is going to be showing her work, and we'll be doing the book signing at the same time. And we're launching the book on Amazon. So our big launch, we've done a soft launch, but our big launch is July 1st on Amazon.
You know, thinking about society and its rituals, it seems like American society has been, again, taken over a little bit by consumerism, where ancient rituals just don't exist much or are viewed maybe with some wariness. In Judaism, you have the bar and the bat mitzvah, where you become a man or a woman, adult, so to speak. But we don't have that. There's no rituals that are accepted and widespread in this country to do with aging, it seems to me.
I think that, unfortunately, there's kind of these age blocks that people come up with. So if you're over, you know, if you look at blocks of when you're filling out a form, it's like over 50, over 65, and then that's it. And let's look at like the demographics of what our country is looking like. There is a huge number of people that's over 65. So to lump everyone over 50 or over 65 as older adults, there are varying degrees of what people are experiencing at those different ages. I mean, I will never forget going to visit Lucky Louie, because I would go and watch him while he was making his mozzarellas and hang out with him usually once a week. And when he was 97, I remember going there and saying, "Hey, Lou, how are you doing this morning?" And he would say, "Well, you know, it's not like when I was 95. And that was his way of, you know, hey, I know that my body is not the same as it was when I was a little younger. Yeah. But I think accepting it and moving on from there, and I think that we as a society tend to put labels on people when they get to a certain age rather than looking at each individual and what they can bring to the table.
Yeah, again, I think that's probably the marketing, you know, where certain demographics are going to buy certain kinds of cars, drink certain kinds of beer, et cetera. And it's might be useful for commerce, but I don't think it works well for getting along. Could you describe for us preconceptions that proved not to be true or things you found that were a surprise?
First of all, I should say I'm an artist. I'm not a social scientist. So I came at this from a very artistic point of view, I suppose, and a very personal one. I always tell my students the more personal, the more universal the message. And so, as I mentioned earlier, I was looking at 50 and that age and looking for positive role models. So I was looking for people that were 75 plus who were positive individuals. And I think that that's important to remember because it wasn't a cross section of everyone that's 75 and older. It was really people that I could perceive as being my role model of what I would like to become. And I think that they all had three common traits. The first was really having a sense of purpose. And I think that one of the things that happens when we are working, we tend to define ourselves. If somebody says, what do? We talk about our profession, our job. We don't talk about all the other things. And so many times when people retire from a career, they're kind of in a no man's land of not knowing what their sense of purpose is. I also see it in college students who maybe start in one major and realize that's not what they want to do. And they kind of also feel like they're in that no man's land. And I think that was a very big surprise, is knowing that having that sense of purpose is so vitally important, and it can change throughout our lives, but we all need to feel like we have a sense of purpose and why we get up every morning, what we're doing, whether it's Lucky Louie making mozzarellas every morning, or, you know, another person in the film, Rose Albano Ballesteros, who teaches English as a second language every morning. I mean, it can run the gamut, but I think having that sense of purpose. I think the other thing was really having a good support system. And I guess the surprise there was that it didn't necessarily have to be family. It could, in many cases, it was just having a good support system of friends. And that has been proven since I've done the film. There's studies that are done about how having friends and a good support system actually leads to a longer, happier life. And I think lastly is this idea of resilience and positivity and attitude kind of all rolled into one, which is that all the people that I interviewed had something really traumatic that they went through in their lives. But it's about the attitude with which that we deal with those things. So, you know, many times we'll go through something traumatic, but how we deal with it in the moment and also how we reflect back on it and move forward from that moment on, I think is very important.
I think it's super important, as you mentioned, for people to have a network of people that they care about each other, they depend on each other, they borrow a cup of sugar from each other. Mm-hmm. So metaphorically speaking, they share their troubles with those people, family, friends, colleagues sometimes. I think churches can be good for that and other religious institutions. And this is sort of an antidote to what's apparently, or experts are calling a national public health crisis, which is just of loneliness. Mm-hmm. When you do get separated from your work, by retirement, let's say, or disability, you tend to lose a social circle there of people you say hi to every day or keep up with and so forth. And so I'm sure that each one of the people that you interviewed for the book and for the movie, they're partly defined, their well-being is partly defined by the well-being of others. Mm-hmm. And even giving back to others, I think, I mean, it's a cliche, but if you're depressed, put that aside momentarily with the intent and think about somebody else who might need a hand or a phone call or an errand run. And it's great medicine. What can you say would be, as we sort of wind up towards the end of our discussion, what would be some practical avenues for reconnecting the elderly and everyone else to mutual benefit? You mentioned classes. Are those community classes? Are they in an educational setting? What are things average people can do?
Yeah, what I've been doing has been through the, you know, university-sponsored classes. And so that's one way. But personally, I was feeling like I needed to develop a better support system of friends. And so what I did was I hosted a women's dinner the first Monday of every month, a big potluck. And people range from ages 20 to 90. And so I think you in your own life, it doesn't have to be something monumental. It can be something as small as inviting people to dinner, having them invite their friends. And all of a sudden, you have a network of 150 people that Wow. You didn't have before. And getting involved, like you mentioned, I think that one of the ways that people people can connect is by giving back and by doing volunteer work. That also puts you in a situation where you're meeting other people and getting connected to other people. You know, I think there are organizations that certainly need help, and it's a good way to connect and network and make a really good support group of friends who are very much times like-minded, because if you pick an organization that you really believe in, they're going to be like-minded and people that you would want to, you know, be friendly with. So start small. You know, it doesn't have to be monumental. It can be something as small as inviting some friends over for dinner and see where it goes from there.
Remind us one more time about some of those upcoming events for the launch of your book.
The book is live on Amazon, and it's the big launch is July 1st. And then we are doing a big book signing at Slow Provisions in San Luis Obispo on July 5th from 5 to 8 p.m.
And everyone is invited.
Everyone is invited. It's part of Art After Dark. So actually, the artist that's going to be at Slow Provisions is Paula DeLay, who's a wonderful painter. I'm delighted to be sharing the space with her at that time. So 5 to 8 p.m. July 5th for Art After Dark at Slow Provisions.
And the food is great there, too.
Yes.
I've been there. I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we were joined by Sky Bergman with her launching of her new book, Lives Well-Lived, Generations, Resilience, Positivity, and Purpose at Every Age. Thank you, Sky.
Thank you for having me.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, Playing with Food.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. Funny story. Back in December 2019, in the post-Christmas sales, I bought the pasta attachment for my standing mixer. I had zero interest in making fresh pasta, which you can hear more about in the Playing with Food pasta episode. My goal was to learn how to make better pot stickers after having produced the pot sticker episode. And bow. Why a pasta roller? Because I'm not good at getting dough evenly thick, so I thought the pasta roller would help. But something was happening around that time that would change the way I used my pasta maker, and I've only made bao, I think, twice in the past 4.5 years. What is bao? The Nam Wah Tea Parlor is New York City's oldest Chinese restaurant, and here is what owner Wilson Tang wrote about bao.
Back in the early days of dim sum, there were no ovens along the Silk Road, so everything, bread included, was steamed. A far simpler process than baking. One of the best things that emerged from the clouds of steam was the bao. Pillowy rolls of moist lily-white dough filled with morsels of protein. You could write an entire cookbook. Hell, fill a library even with recipes for bao. Bao just means a stuffed bun, and a stuffed bun can be as great and varied as whatever is in it. In the world of dim sum, and more generally grab-and-go Chinese food, which is most Chinese food, bao holds a place of privilege. It is the grabbiest and goiest and gooeyest and goodest street snack. You don't need chopsticks. You don't need a plate. You just need hands and a mouth.
The pillowy white buns holding precious filling, they are super delicious, but they are a pain to make. And you have to have friends and family around to make it worth it. But now I don't need to make bao because it's right on my doorstep. Follow me to Bing's Bao in the Slow Public Market.
Yeah, my name is Mike. I own Bing's Bao Buns along with my wife. Her name's Sam.
What made you decide to do Bao Buns? Are you an expert at Bao?
I'm not an expert at anything, but it's something that we weren't able to find here on the Central Coast, so we figured we'll go ahead and make it ourselves.
Did either of you like grow up making them in your family?
No, pretty much just picked it up on a whim, watched a lot of YouTube videos, got a feel for it, and we've been doing it for about 7 or 8 years now.
How long did it take you to do the perfect little folding at the top thing?
Still far from perfect, but we've been working at it for quite some time. Some of the people that we've brought in since opening are better at it than I am at this point. We're both from the East Coast. We've transplanted out here from New Jersey and basically couldn't find some of the food that we loved eating. So we started making it out of our house, and then people started to catch wind of it, so they were ordering it out of our home, and that just snowballed and basically gave us an excuse to get better and better at the crafts. We had an opportunity here at the public market when it opened up. It seemed like a good spot for us because we don't have to worry about quarter service and everything else that comes along with a restaurant. Our original idea was oriented towards a food truck, but it's pretty hard to survive in a truck around here.
We're back here in the kitchen. What kind of ingredients do you use?
We change the menu every week, so we pretty much use everything. Anything from seafood to venison meat. We've had pork, of course, beef, lots of mushrooms. The benefit to being a small company is we can kind of change on a whim. Whatever's fresh in season is what we're going to be cooking with.
Can we go out here and look at the menu really quickly?
Yeah, the menu is going to change all the time.
I've been here twice before.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I came, I had the Philly cheesesteak bao.
Yeah.
And it amazingly tastes like a Philly cheesesteak in a bao.
Pretty close.
Yeah,
pretty
yeah.
close.
So yeah. Congratulations on doing that. Because sometimes when you try to do the fusion stuff, it doesn't quite work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But looking at your menu, you have the section on handmade bao.
Yep.
And it only has four. So is your idea to keep it simple?
Well, it's all made by hand, so you're talking about somebody physically wrapping every single one of those by hand. We used to only have two flavors. Some days we only had one, and as we've grown, we've kind of been able to get more and more each day.
Let's go back in the kitchen. When it comes to your sauces and things, that's another specialty technique, not just the folding of the bao. And how do you do your sauces?
Just trial and error, really. It took a lot of time to find the soy sauce that we really like, and then just going around to some of our favorite restaurants and trying to dissect what they're doing and put our own spin on it. When it comes to the bao itself, we kind of have to be careful. If the sauce is too loose, it becomes impossible to wrap. We've played around with different ways to thicken up the sauce and make sure that it's coating and it's doing everything it needs to inside the bao without running out. Everything, for the most part, is made in-house, so it's things that we've just made hundreds of times and keep getting better and better. Just using fresh ingredients helps. Like, we're always grinding up garlic and ginger and onion and going through tons of green onion. And we get our soy sauce from Hawaii, so it's a little bit of a sweeter soy sauce. It's not as aggressive as like a Kikkoman. We use a local honey. Honey is very helpful over sugar, especially when it comes to making that sauce thicker.
A restaurant devoted to bao. Brilliant. I want to know how they are made so I can get all the right tips to make them at home if I get inspired again. So we start with the dough with Trent.
Okay, we have the yeast started with the sugar, an ounce of oil, and then you're gonna do a pinch salt. And make sure that the oil, the yeast starter, everything, the salt is all in there, just like that. And you're just gonna run it one time through. It doesn't need to be anything intense. Cover it. Once I've dropped that in there, I'll come back over here and start my next set of okay. sugar and yeast, just to be time efficient. We're just gonna mix it in, just like so. I use a little bit of a twisting and fist motion just to press everything.
Like with bread dough, are you going until it's smooth and elastic?
Yes. You'll see it in a second. It's really gonna tighten up here. And it's really gonna have a nice smooth surface. Mostly what I do here is that I'll make the noodle dough or I'll make the bao dough. As you can see, it's kind of folding in here. It's all coming together really nicely. And that is what we're looking for, right about there, just like that. And it's about, I would say, you know, about the size of a big softball. And then we're gonna cover it and then we're gonna let that sit between 45 and an hour. All right, you ready to make some bao?
Yeah.
Let's do it. So I'm just gonna start right from the jump here.
Okay.
All right. So I'll do 6 dough balls, not because it's efficient or that's how you should do it. I just don't want them to merge together as they are getting steamed. So as they get steamed, they get bigger and I don't want them to mush together. I want them to keep their surface. I want them to keep their shape so that everyone gets the same amount of dough and everyone's just getting the same bao as much as possible is between 55 and 60 grams. So right there, that's 53, 57. I like that one. 58. I like that one. 60?
Exactly 60.
Yeah.
I like how you can get it on almost one shot because you know what they're supposed to be.
It's just kind of the feel. Every morning's a little different.
6 perfect little dough balls.
In this part, I'm going to try to smooth it out as much as I can. Here, boom. Getting them nice and kind of round as much as I can. This will help when I roll it out. All right, a little bit of flour on your surface. Flour on your rolling pin. This is all about whether the dough is hard or it's really soft. Sometimes you press down on it and it just goes everywhere, expands quick. Other mornings when it's cold, you gotta really work into it. Right now it's pretty good. I'm trying to get a nice round disc of dough, just like that.
How big are you going for?
Size of like a street taco tortilla. We're gonna go around the edge and we're gonna push dough into the center of the dough disc. So that way, when we start wrapping, any sauce or like fatty moisture that's in the meat doesn't break through the bottom as it's steaming.
So that's kind of the opposite of pizza. It's like on pizza dough, you have a wider outer corona, and here your corona is flatter, and then you have plump in the middle.
Yes, that's right. Okay.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian at Bing's Bao in San Luis Obispo, learning how to make bao buns, those white fluffy dough balls filled with delicious Cantonese flavors. But like Wilson Tang from Nam Hoa described bao, they can be filled with anything. Bing's Bao takes that to the next level. Philly cheesesteak filling. And here's where I get schooled on how to wrap the bun.
What do we have?
This is char siu, I believe.
Okay.
Pork. So we're gonna go like that. Now this one is pretty saucy.
Okay.
You gotta watch your fingers when you do this, because as your fingers touch it, it'll get a little bit of that juice, a little bit of that sauce. And then if you touch the dough, it'll stain the dough. And then that kind of ruins like its overall appearance on the outside. Okay. Just like this, nice and easy all the way around. Pinch.
You're holding it in one hand.
Yep.
And then
turning it in the other.
And pinching it at the same time.
That's right.
It looks like you're wrapping your thumb inside of it.
Yes, so right there, like if you're talking about my left hand here, my thumb is still inside of it. That's to keep the filling in place. And now I'm gonna come around, and now I have a nice little opening right there. Gonna come all the way around and twist and pinch. Come all the way around one more time. Make sure it's all nice and even. As even as you can.
And then you have this little volcano thing in the middle.
That's what everyone keeps calling it.
It's beautiful. Look at perfect pleats and everything. In like 30 seconds.
And so what I'm doing here now, I'll just go around and I just kind of smooth out the edges here and just try to get a nice little, as round as I can get it. And then just repeat. Take my time with it. For me, I want to try to do as good a job as I can. I want to try to give it a nice presentation.
Then it was my turn to have a go. Trent was very patient with me. In the end, there was structural integrity, which is good. But visually, I don't think they would want to serve that to a paying customer. So I guess I'll have to eat it after it's cooked.
Okay.
All right, let's take a look at it. Let's see what we got.
And then how do you volcano it?
The volcano, it comes, you have to want to push down with your right thumb and bring it all around.
Okay, I see.
There you go. There it is.
Okay, not the most beautiful.
So now that we have all of our six here, so we're gonna take it over the steamer. We're gonna set it on top of the steamer. You just want a nice, easy going boil here. Gonna grab a top for it, cover it, leave it be. We're gonna set a timer for 8 minutes. And in 8 minutes, these guys are gonna be cooked. The filling is gonna be nice and warm and cooked through. And the dough, it's gonna expand it, and that's how you're gonna get your nice fluffy dough.
Do you ever stack more than one steamer?
Yes. We try not to go anything higher than two.
I'm assuming the cooking time is different for the top.
It's more of a touch and feel. We make sure we touch the bottoms, make sure that everything is nice and warm and hot.
Is the filling already cooked?
Yes.
I've made bao like 3 times, and the last time I made it was for Chinese New Year this year, and I was using a raw pork filling.
Okay, how'd that work out?
It was fine, except I oversteamed it and they deflated.
Oh.
Because I wanted to make sure the pork was cooked.
Gotcha. Everything's cooked ahead of time before, I mean, once it goes in our trays as a filling here, before it even goes into the bao, everything's cooked.
The ones I made were perfectly smooth globes because I hold all the dough up and pinched it and then rolled it around my hands until it was a perfectly smooth globe because I can't do the pleating.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, I've seen it that way too. Yeah, that's a good way to do it. There's a whole bunch of different ways. Sometimes, depending on the mornings, whether it's kind of cooler in here or if it's kind of hotter in here, we'll have to make some halftime adjustments as we go through the day. How they're feeling, how they're looking, making sure that they're getting cooked all the way through. At this point, all of us here have had enough of them in our hands that if it's not cooked all the way through, it can be a little sticky. Like the outer part can be sticky. Gooey still. That's not good. You want to make sure that they go in and that they come out nice and bready.
What's usually wrong with them when they get sent back, or do they ever get sent back?
They haven't gotten sent back. Usually when they get sent back, it's because they're too spicy.
Spicy.
Too spicy, bro.
Yeah.
Some people send back because it wasn't what they expected. Like the char siu pork we do is very different. It's more of like a Cantonese style, where some people are used to like the very food coloring red, sweet pork. Ours is more of like a traditional Cantonese style. So we start with a lu shi base and then a lot of five spice, oyster sauce, sugar, and we get a nice local honey from a guy up in Paso. So we add that to the glaze. And the five spice is a little strong for some people, but we get a lot of positive feedback too.
So where are we on time?
We're at 45 seconds.
Ooh.
Okay, that was 8 minutes. So I'm just gonna take it off just like so.
Wow, they grew twice the size.
Yeah, I wanna feel them. And they're a little tacky, but they are bready and they are done. when you put too many of them in here, they can kind of like smoosh together a little bit, and you kind of get edges like this. And it's just a little bit of tearing. Yeah. I try to avoid that by throwing six in there, or this one here, where it's nice and smooth, symmetrical all the way around. The presentation of it looks
good. Except for that one.
No, that's the best one of the bunch. That's the best one right there. Feel the bottom here.
Okay.
See how it's nice and tight?
Yep.
That's when we push all the dough to the center. That's what that's creating. When you cook these with other ones and there's a tear in the bottom, the cheese or the juice or the sauce of that particular filling will come out and it will stain the other bowls and it'll make them soggy and mushy. So that's why you want to have a nice, thick bottom. We're going to check yours. Oh, it's great. There it is.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian at Bing's Bao in San Luis Obispo, about ready to devour a twist on a Cantonese bao bun. Instead of the typical Cantonese spiced pork, this fluffy white dough ball is cuddling a healthy portion of Philly cheesesteak-inspired filling.
What's the proper way to eat them?
I mean, I just go ahead and bite right into it.
Okay.
Best way to do it is to take a small bite, then you can pour the sauce into the bao.
Okay.
And then you're good from there.
But this one probably doesn't need sauce since it's Philly cheesesteak.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
This is a Philly cheesesteak bao. Mmm, these are good. The dough is nice and light and fluffy. And the Philly cheesesteak tastes like a Philly cheesesteak. It's just amazing.
Take a lot of pride in making sure that that filling to bao dough ratio is pretty high.
What's more important, the dough or the filling or the sauce?
You don't want to have a fillingless bao. So I would say they're equally important, but the dough is the most important thing when it comes to keeping it all together. If you roll the dough out too thin, you're going to have a mess on your hands. You won't be able to hold it like you're holding right now in your hand, taking bites from it.
Right.
It'll start to fall apart.
After that tutorial, Mike gave me some dough. It needed to be used right away, so I rushed home. There was some homemade mac and cheese in the freezer. I thawed that, rolled out the dough like Trent taught me, made balls of mac and cheese, and then had six more opportunities to wrap and shape that bao so it looked nice. I steamed them and then took them to the masters to be reviewed.
So I made mac and cheese bao.
Yeah.
Are you willing to try it?
Oh yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
Oh dang.
All right, here we go.
Okay.
Good.
Carbs on carbs. Welcome to America. What do you think?
Oh, that's good. There's definitely carbs on carbs.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know if I can do more than two of these. It's a lot.
I don't know if I can do more than one of these.
What kind of cheese is this?
Like 17 different types. What sauce do you think would go with it?
Like a really nice marinara would be really good.
Yeah. Oh, you think? Not one of your sauces?
No, like a really nice red sauce.
Okay, I thought you were going to say like sriracha or something.
Like a solid hot sauce? Yeah, I think that would be really good as well.
I learned a few things from Trent about number five. When you're saying make sure you're fingers are kind of on top. I figured that out. And I figured out that I don't have to keep the top.
Yeah.
And you can't do that because you're pushing it around.
Sometimes gravity's even your friend if you flip it a little bit. You can just use gravity to help that plate.
And he did also say, don't make your circle too big. And I did that.
Yeah. Keeping the circumference of the dough when you start small is just going to give you a thicker bottom. If we do anything with seafood, it's going to leak right through if that isn't a nice thick bottom, you know?
Well, thank you for at least trying it.
No, I'm good.
With all this fusion bao, what else have they tried?
We did Thanksgiving-themed turkey with cranberry sauce inside. It was basically turkey stuffing. It had bacon in it and a homemade bread. We made like a cranberry sauce on the side that you could pour into the bao. It was really good. Kimchi corned beef was really good for St. Patty's Day, and we try to make it fun. I mean, we've done a couple different sweet bao, red bean, which I would think would be more popular, but didn't really sell too good. Ever since we've gotten the mochi, we haven't had to do a sweet bao because people go crazy for the mochi. They're really good.
Have you ever thought about expanding into things like soup bao?
Yeah, it's just time consuming and difficult. If you don't have the soup base prepped properly, there's a lot that can go wrong, from getting it to be the right jelly consistency, and then from taking that jelly consistency and wrapping the dumpling around it without it melting. From what I've seen, it's usually best to do soup dumplings in a cold environment. Like, we would want to wrap those while we're downstairs in the refrigerator. And much smaller, instead of using 60 grams of dough, you'd probably be looking at like 20, much, much smaller. And then you're rolling the dough much thinner as well. So it's less of like a bread dough, more of like a pasta dough.
You mentioned that if you leave them too long, they start to brown. Have you guys ever thought of doing baked bao?
Typically, the baked ones are the ones that aren't pleated, like the ones that you made where they're just globes. I've seen those. They're like a golden brown, kind of like a dinner bun type style. I've never had them before. I've always just had them steamed, but I'm sure they're delicious. Taking a couple of these and pan fried them. They're really good pan fried. You get a nice crispy bottom. It's pretty good. Throw some sauce in the pan with it, and you're off and running. basically just start it in a pan with some oil, get it nice and crispy on the bottom, put a lid on top. Before you put the lid on, throw some water in there. Throw the lid on there and 30 seconds, 45 seconds, let it go.
Can a man live on bao alone? I just had to ask.
And how many bao do you eat a day?
How many do I eat a day? I try to keep it under 6. It's a lot. 3 is a good helping. Like, 3 is probably enough for most people.
Coincidentally, that night, Chenda, who's also been on this show, brought bao to my house for dinner. It was Cambodian bao, and it was delicious. Now that I've learned how to make bao from Trent and Mike, I see that there's no purpose for my stand mixer to help me with the dough. I've got to make that little corona. And I think after being taught how to make bao, I just might be inspired to try it home again. This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.